it's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Would you like 2023 to be tax-free? Hey, it's Lars. Then make plans to join David Moore for a free webinar Wednesday, March 29th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time for the latest 1031 exchange news and updates. For those asking for the nitty-gritty of a 1031 exchange, this is your class to learn the basics of the 1031 exchange, what qualifies, and how to apply the process. In this webinar, you'll learn the lingo, a glossary of terms, what you should know about doing an exchange in 2023, the benefits and pitfalls, and flipping with a 1031 exchange. If you're an Oregon broker, this 1031 exchange class provides attendees with 1 hour of core real estate continuing education and the knowledge to identify and apply the 1031 exchange to client investment real estate transactions. Plus, anybody who signs up gets a copy of the slides and a link to view the session again. For more information and registration, go to 1031exchange.com. You've worked hard to earn your money. Equity Advantage works hard to keep it yours. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So another crazy guy with a gun, but it's the crazy guy who did the deed in Texas over the weekend, and people end up dead because of it. And of course, the mainstream media with 8 people dead, at least 7 others wounded in Texas when he opened fire in Allen, Texas at an outlet mall. Of course, they got to find some kind of meme to attach this to. And the person is Hispanic, so they say, well, he must have been a white supremacist. Let me get into that in just a minute. And so what the details are we know about what happened this weekend and what I think that the mainstream media is probably going to put this one in the rearview mirror about as fast as they possibly can. First, welcome to a Monday on the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me. And if you want to jump into our conversation, the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails, and we made that easy to remember too, talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can always vote in our Twitter poll. We actually posted 2 different places, still called the Twitter poll. Yes, we survived the bad years, and now the Elon Musk reforms at Twitter. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show, and also on our website. If you don't want to go to Twitter, just go to LarsLarson.com. The vote counts the same. But let me tell you a bit about Mauricio Garcia, 33 years old, of Dallas. Fact is, he walked into this mall, and for reasons that the authorities still have not entirely figured out, although I think they're going to figure out, the guy was just crazy. Now, what'd they find out? He shoots. He shoots for no apparent reason. People ran. 8 people were killed. 7 people were wounded. And then, as usual, the thing that stops a bad guy with a gun was a good guy with a gun. An off-duty cop who happened to be either at the mall or nearby, who immediately went, and while calling for help, they actually, in the 911 call, says, send everyone. And I understand the situation. When you've got 8 people on the ground dead, you've got 7 people who are wounded, and you've got a guy with a gun, but that officer took him on. He was, of course, carrying off-duty, which is what most police are encouraged to do, and he managed to neutralize the threat, which is what we expect from police. So we've got a crazy guy. Now, why would I say he's crazy? Well, he went into the military about 15 years ago. He didn't even finish out basic training for the Army. They released him, and we're probably never going to know the true specifics of that, but he was released for either mental or physical problems or both. Or one or the other. And he was released from the Army, never completed his basic training, never was assigned to anything, and he was sent on his way. Now, that was 15 years ago. So the fact is, we don't know what he was like 15 years ago. We know the Army said, you're not going to be able to even complete your basic training. And we don't know what his motivation may have been that would have driven him to do something like this. But the videos that have already been released, he apparently just stepped out of his car and immediately began shooting people, and people began running. And as I said, there was heroic action by an off-duty cop who was at the mall, heard the gunfire, and as always with public safety, ran in the direction of gunfire and killed Mr. Garcia. Thank God. It might have been much worse. And of course, already the mainstream media is reporting it this way. The 200th mass shooting this year. Yeah, there are organizations out there that are dead set on telling Americans you're not going to be able to own guns. And they want to take away the Second Amendment. And I'm not kidding. Joe Biden wants to do it. Many of the Democrat liberals want to do it, most of them, and an awful lot of private groups that try to make the argument that somehow if you disarm all the law-abiding citizens in the country, which means only the bad guys will have guns, that somehow you're going to solve the problem. They always talk about this as gun violence, as though a person never has anything to do with it. It's only the gun that is violent. Let me tell you a couple of factoids because I want to give you good information that you can actually act on. Fact number one, of all the violent crime in America, now if you don't know what that is, violent crime is rape, robbery, murder, assault, all of those kinds of crimes, 92% of it is committed without any use of a gun. Only 8% of violent crime in America involves a gun. 92% is without a gun. So even if you thought that if you could, by taking away the right of Americans to own guns at all, and you stripped every single gun out of the hand of every single law-abiding citizen in America, that you'd still have solved 8% of the crimes. The other 92% of violent crime would still be going on. And I'd be the first to agree with you. If you say America has a gigantic problem with violent crime, I agree. And 8% of it involves guns and 92% does not. And if you want to know the source of that information, it's the Crime Prevention Research Center. I can send you right to the website. It's not hard at all to find. So when your liberal friends talk about gun violence, we got to solve gun violence. You want to have some fun with them? Just turn to one of these liberal nitwits that says that to you and say, oh, well, that might address 8% of the crime in America. What do you want to do about the other 92%? And when they look at you like a deer caught in the headlights and you say, I don't understand what you mean. You say, well, 8% of the violent crime involves guns. 92% does not. Now, they're already casting Mauricio Garcia as a white supremacist because he visited different websites, because he said things online, except he's a person of color himself. Now, the distinction for most mainstream media, just so you know ahead of time, is that Mauricio Garcia is Hispanic, and Hispanic is not a race. It's an ethnicity. Like, that makes any difference to the people who are dead on the ground. Let me focus instead on the things that are actually relevant to what happened over the weekend in Allen, Texas. Number one, I'd like to know. Usually there are three things that will disqualify you from buying a gun. Number one is if you're a convicted felon. Number two is a domestic violence accusation or domestic violence conviction. And that can even include a fist fight with your brother where the cops are called. You get cited for that, you may lose your Second Amendment rights altogether. But the third reason is if a judge has said, I'm going to send you to some kind of mental health care and I'm ordering you to go to some kind of mental health treatment or be locked up or otherwise your freedom taken away so your mental health issues can be addressed. In that case, you can't buy a gun. Here's what I'd like to know. When you fill out that form 4473, the federal form to buy a gun, it applies in every state in America. It asks you whether or not you've ever been ordered for mental health treatment. Would that also include the U.S. Army when they say you've got a mental health problem, you're not going to be able to finish out basic training? I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to see if I can find it for you. In the meantime, if you want to sound off, and we always put naysayers to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can always vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Coming up, a little commentary in the Northwest nonsense on the Radio Northwest Network about all the corruption that has just been uncovered in the last couple of weeks in the state of Oregon. We'll get that next on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
I may get some naysayers on this, but I have to say the crimes of so many Oregon officials and the ones we've found out about in just the last couple of weeks demand some kind of explanation. And so far, Governor Tina Kotek ain't saying much, which may be, well, she's already the least popular governor in all of America. All 50 governors, and she's the least popular governor, and she's brand spanking new to the office. What does that tell you? She's hiding right now. Bribery and criminal misconduct by Democrat Shamia Fagan for the money she got from the weed retailer LaMota. Democrat Kotek refuses to demand a criminal investigation of that. Remember, Kotek also got donations from that pot retailer. Democrat and new member of Congress Val Hoyle also got big bucks from LaMota and then steered a $500,000 state contract to one of the company's owners while she was the Boley Commissioner, Bureau of Labor and Industries. She's staying mum as well. Do you sense a pattern here? All Democrats and all apparently involved in corruption at taxpayer expense. Kotek won her spot as governor with $500,000 stolen from the customers of the FTX cryptocurrency scam. That money came to Kotek's Democrat Party illegally under a false name. It still hasn't been paid back. And by the way, now former Secretary of State Fagan ordered that the investigation of that apparent criminal activity be done by a former top official of, wait for it, the Democrat Party. Meanwhile, over at the state legislature, the Democrat supermajorities have ignored Oregon's most pressing problems like killer drugs and violent crime to pass outrages like abortion for 10-year-olds and mutilation of children to satisfy transgender politics. Citizens must demand an explanation, an investigation, and a prosecution. Rena wrote in with this email, Lars, one thing that should be on everybody's mind, if Joe Biden goes through with getting rid of the dollar and making everything with your money digital, signed this back in 2021, and she's right, he did, and is expected to roll out this year or sometime early next year. If this happens, this will be catastrophic to America. He is selling America out to China, signed Rena. And by the way, let me give you a little update that literally came in just as I was beginning the program today. Joe Biden has problems. His son has problems. His son may be about to be indicted by the Department of Justice. We have waited years for the FBI and the DOJ to act on the information they knew about the crimes of Hunter Biden. Guess what just happened? The newspaper, the oldest newspaper in America that has led the pack in terms of telling the public about Hunter Biden, about his laptop, about his crooked deals in Beijing and in Ukraine, The New York Post, not the Washington Post, has now been banned from Joe Biden's latest public events. Why? Is Joe Biden afraid that somebody from a newspaper might ask him a few questions about what he knows about his son's crimes and about whether or not those crimes put any money into the pocket of the big guy? I think Joe Biden and his staff are running scared, and the media needs to get on board and start asking the hard questions, whether it's the New York Post that does it or somebody else. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Better Basements and Waterproofing. Water in your crawl space or basement? Call Better Basements and Waterproofing.
Well, I got to give today's Daily Grill to Forbes magazine, and I've never done that before. I used to think highly of Forbes magazine. The problem is lately they've begun firing anybody who has a conservative point of view, including some people you've heard on this show. And now what have they come out with? They've come out with this recommendation. The city of Portland, Oregon is one of the best places in America to travel to, according to Forbes magazine. I know any of you who've ever driven around the city or in the city or in down the roads, the freeways that lead into the city, you have to wonder. It looks like a giant hobo camp, and crime has gone up and violence has gone up. and things have been destroyed, by, especially starting with the riots about 3 years ago, driven by Antifa and BLM. But the business magazine Forbes says leading women travel experts and influencers for their favorite travel destinations put on their list this year the best American cities to visit, and they say Portland is one of them. And Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, who seems capable of ignoring what his own lying eyes are telling him and just simply saying what he has to say to stay as popular as he is, he calls the list Portland a phoenix rising from its ashes. If anybody agrees with that conclusion, I'd love to take the naysayer call. Glad to get your calls, too. If you want to jump in on a Monday to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here on the Radio Northwest Network at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Alan Painter writes, Lars, this is Oregon politics at its best. A governor who grants clemency to a murderer without even contacting the victim's family. I would have thought a sentence for life without the possibility of parole is exactly that. What kind of person cares more about the prisoner than the victim or their family? And this was just one prisoner. There were hundreds more, and not just misdemeanors, but rapists, pedophiles, and even murderers. My biggest concern when we're looking at a trial down the road is this: a governor who could care less about the very people she's supposed to protect. I'm not against giving people a second chance, but when the voters have voted more than once to hold criminals accountable for their crimes, that is the will of the people. I always thought governors were in place to uphold the will of the people who legally voted for certain laws. No lawmaker or governor should be able to circumvent the will of the people by the stroke of a pen, behind closed doors, and in total secrecy. Not only letting prisoners out early, but changing their names so there's no criminal record to follow. I'm not sure how many other states have similar policies, but I think their voters certainly have a right to know what their lawmakers are doing behind closed doors. We know for certain that California and Washington have let thousands of prisoners out early, just like their partner in crime, Oregon. How far-reaching is this cancer across our country? It is Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Our Twitter poll today: if the government sends out money by mistake, should it demand that you pay it back? Turns out that Oregon Department of Human Services has accidentally sent out thousands of pandemic EBT, electronic benefits transaction cards, worth about $1.46 million, and they're not making anybody return the money. They sent the cards out to reimburse parents of the kids who are on the free lunch program during COVID. Can you believe this? So the state of Oregon accidentally sends out a bunch of money. Number one, they should be faulted and somebody ought to get fired. If at your private job you accidentally sent $1.46 million, actually, if you sent out accidentally $14,000 of the company's money, would you expect to keep your job? Well, I would expect everybody in Salem who participated in this colossal error probably keeps his or her job, or these days, their job, since we have to go by pronouns these days. It's a Monday. Your calls are welcome, and naysayers go first on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, where we've been serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the last 23-plus years. And I have to tell you about the Greater Oregon Movement. I have my own opinions about it. Would I like to see Oregon trimmed down in size and some of the counties added to Idaho? Not necessarily. But I also believe in self-determination. If people in eastern Oregon counties say, we're not very well represented by Salem, just as I would expect eastern Washington counties would say, we're not very well represented by Seattle and Olympia, I'd have to agree with them. And if they decide it's bad enough that they want to join another state, I'm completely in favor of them being able to decide. The problem is there is an active Greater Idaho movement going on. It appears to be getting an amazing amount of success, not 100%, but an amazing amount of success in a number of counties. And now we're seeing what appears to be an illegal effort to shut down the right of citizens to go about self-determination. Now, nobody knows that better than Mike McCarter, who joins me now. He's president of Move Oregon's Border. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. It's good to be back on the program again.
Before we go any further, tell people where they can find the effort of Move Oregon's Border so I don't forget to get it later on in the segment. Then we'll talk about what's going on with this illegal effort to stop you. Where can they find it and how can they help out?
Yes. If you're interested in the Move Oregon's Border Project or now Greater Idaho or Citizens for Greater Idaho, you can go to greateridaho.org on the website. And there's all kinds of information, questions, answers, and everything on that site.
Very good. Now, tell me this. Every bit of spending that your group, because it's a political group, has done, you've complied with the laws in the state that say that you have to say how you raised the money, who you raised it from, and how you spent it. You've done all that, right?
Correct. Yeah. In the way the Secretary of State Elections Division is set up, if you come out in favor of a measure, you have to take and establish a measure committee as an organization and report every penny, and I don't mean dollar, but every penny of income and expenditure. Otherwise, you're in violation of the law.
Now, that's fair. I don't have a problem with that kind of transparency, but it's supposed to work for both sides. Is there an organized movement to try to stop moving the Oregon border?
Well, some of the citizens in Wallowa County who are in favor of this coming up on their ballot on May 16th started contacting us towards the latter part of April about receiving postcards, mailers, and videos about opposition to that. Well, that's fine. If you don't agree, go ahead and do the advertising and everything. We contacted ORSTAR, which is the Secretary of State Election Division, and to get a little background on this group. Well, the group is there, which is called Western States Strategy, but they don't show any measure in opposition, filing, expenses, or anything else. So at that point, we said, well, we need to file a complaint. And Secretary of State Elections office says, well, you'll have to do the digging in the background. And we did. And sent all that in on Friday, I filed a complaint on campaign finance violations.
Because if they failed to disclose that they're spending money in opposition to the Greater Idaho movement, then they've broken the law. Is it a criminal violation potentially?
Well, the complaint starts an investigation with the Secretary of State's office. What they come up with as far as a violation, whether it's criminal or fines or whatever comes out of it, is up to them. If they negotiate with the people to come back in and pay the penalties and file everything, I'm sure that there probably would not be any charges filed against them.
Fair enough. Do you think you're getting the full attention of the Secretary of State's office, given that the Secretary of State's office is in a bit of disarray with the resignation announced last week but effective today of Secretary of State Shamia Fagan and the corruption that she apparently involved herself in? Can you be confident that Oregon voters will get the full attention of the Secretary of State's office in circumstances like that?
Yes, I really am, Lars, because I work with them almost on a weekly basis on showing all of our information and everything. And when we talked to them on Friday, they were extremely helpful. They said, we have no way of researching everything. So would you do the background research on it, put it together, and include it in with your complaint there? And we're following up on it. They got back to me within 6 hours saying they received a complaint, and they're going to start the investigations.
Although, Mike, I've got to tell you something. This kind of bothers me in this sense. If you call the police and say, hey, I think there's a bank robbery going on down the street, and they say, okay, why don't you go down there and find out if it is a bank robbery, identify the suspects, go do all the basic field work for us, and then when you tell us about it, we'll come after it. No, you've alerted the Secretary of State's office to what is a possible violation. And they say to you, we don't have the resources to investigate. Because all they'd have to, in my mind, what I would do is say, we've been told that you're running a campaign. Send a message to the contact at this Western States outfit and say, are you, in fact, running a campaign? Are you spending money on that campaign? And if so, why aren't we seeing that you filed filed the paperwork to justify that under the law. But they're basically, it's saying that somebody can cheat in Oregon elections, and as long as nobody does the groundwork and nobody files a complaint, the cheating can go on, and the Secretary of State's office is completely ignorant of it. Is that the system we've got?
I'm not sure about that, Lars, because this is the first time we've come across this particular issue on it.
Okay.
But we filed the complaint. I'm going to be following up on it almost on a weekly basis to find out what's going on with it there. And they have spent a lot of money on mailers, on printing, on videos, and in some cases, like with the videos, they tried to hide it anonymously where you could not figure out who actually paid for the video. So to me, it looks like there is intent to not follow the rules here. And we included every bit of that evidence in our campaign or our complaint.
Good for you, because, Mike, one of the things you hear on radio commercials in campaigns, because there are a lot of campaigns, both for candidates and ballot measures, that use radio, and I hear them all the time, and they have all kinds of identifiers on them. You know, candidates saying, I'm so-and-so, and I've approved this message, or put, you know, this message brought to you by the committee for X, Y, and Z, and they do all that identification. The fact that the organization may have been putting out its message without any of those identifiers, to me, suggests that they're trying to hide that it's a political group doing it. I think that should be viewed as a much more serious violation of the law. It's one thing if you just forget to file the paperwork. Okay, file the paperwork. But if you're putting out videos and mailers and everything else, and they don't have the proper identification on them, that to me suggests the guilty mind. It suggests you know that what you're doing is wrong, and you don't want anybody to be able to identify who it is that's doing something wrong. Give us the website address again, Mike, please.
Yes, greateridaho.org.
Greateridaho.org. Mike McCarter is the president of what was Move Oregon's Border, now greateridaho.org. Mike, thanks very much. I appreciate it. We'll talk to a naysayer in the next segment. And by the way, I don't have much respect for the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, whether it's the Seattle Times or OregonLive.com. But now, one of the Daily Dead Fish Wrappers says you should trust your government masters and don't keep raising questions about what your government masters have in mind. I'll give you the specifics on that. Coming up next, it's Monday. It's the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. If the government sends out money by mistake, should it demand that you pay it back? I'd say, of course it should. And yet, Oregon Department of Human Services accidentally sent out $1.46 million worth of EBT cards, and they sent them out to kids. They sent them out to reimburse parents of kids who are on the free lunch program during COVID. And they say, oopsie, we accidentally sent out money. We never should have done that. Should the money have to be paid back? I would answer yes. You can answer any way you like at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. We always love naysayers, so I want to go first to Don, who's calling in from Bremerton, listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Don, what do you and I disagree about today?
Hi, Lars. Just about this dirtbag in Texas.
Yeah.
I've seen evidence and some pictures and things that he was covered in Hispanic gang tattoos. So I kind of don't think, I kind of think the white supremacist angle doesn't quite flow through there. Also, he was administratively separated from the Army, which does not remove his rights to own firearms. It would have to have been a dishonorable discharge or an adjudication in court of mental illness to make him ineligible to own firearms.
Let me ask you something, though, Don, because the first question that occurred was, if the military has said, we're not even going to let you finish basic, you have mental problems that make it impossible for you to finish basic, should that be included in the information that you get from the background check? When you fill out the form 4473, which I've done dozens of times, they then send you for a background check, but they ask you, have you ever been adjudged to be, you know, mentally defective, or, you know, have you ever been committed to a mental institution as a result of an order of a judge? But if the military has said you have problems that are severe enough that you can't even finish basic, should that information be in the background check?
Well, it maybe should be on the background check, but it's not an automatic disqualifier.
I wouldn't want it to be done, because I've made the argument before that when people call in and say, if somebody is undergoing counseling or say they're on antidepressants, they shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And I say, oh, so you want to take a sizable percentage of veterans of military service who do come back. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them come back with PTSD. They come back with troubles, you know, in sleeping. They come back with depression. And you say, would you deny all of them the right to own a gun? I wouldn't. So I think those should be case by case. But that, of course, depends on a background check system that's more than just check the record and straight up or down, yes or no. I agree with you on that. But all I was asking, and I didn't say that his separation from military would have been on it. I just said it should be asked.
Yes, I see your point, and it perhaps should be looked at. But, of course, do we want a committee of faithless bureaucrats in the FBI or wherever sitting down to decide whether we are allowed to exercise our Second Amendment rights?
No, I don't. But we already, Don, you're talking about the status quo. We already have that. For example, Dylann Roof, who they call the Charlottesville killer, the guy who walked into a church, sat and prayed with a bunch of people for an hour and a half, and then killed them all. And you say, well, he was sold a gun. Do you know why he was sold a gun? Because he lied on the form 4473, which is not just a federal crime, but lying on it is grounds for, number one, disqualification to buy a gun. Number two, for prosecution, because when you sign that form, it says right there, signing this form, if you put false information on it, is a crime. Well, what the FBI screwed up on that is that, and I'm going to pull from memory, but what they did was they sent that one for further background, and a woman who was handling that background check was supposed to call Columbia City and instead called Columbia in that state, a different town. And she said, do you have any record of this guy? And the police department said, no, we don't. Well, she was calling the wrong city. And then he was approved to buy the gun. 2 months went by, during which time the FBI discovered that it had made a mistake and should have said, we've found the mistake, we've called the right jurisdiction, where he had, Dylann Roof had admitted to the police that he was a user of illegal drugs, which is a disqualifier on the form. Should the FBI have said, hey, to the gun, go back and retrieve that gun, it was sold to him in error. They did not do that. People died, and that's a result. But this is where the government already is acting like a committee, a bunch of bureaucrats who get to say yes or no to whether or not you buy a gun. Now, for most people, they run the background check, you come up clean, you buy the gun, and that's that. But on some of them, they do some additional some additional checks. And in this case, they just flat out screwed up. Now, do you think anybody in the federal government at the FBI or the DOJ is going to admit that they screwed up in that way? Because they made it possible for that young man to have a gun the day he murdered all those people.
Yeah. Well, the same was true of the shooter in the Texas church
who Southern Spring.
Had a domestic violence conviction in the Air Force, but they did not put that into the national background check system. So
that's what they should have done. Don, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, it hasn't even been 1 year since the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'm glad they did it, essentially overturned Roe v. Wade. The case they considered was called Dobbs, and they essentially threw out the idea that somewhere in the Constitution you could find a federal constitutional right to abortion because it's not in the document. And the Supreme Court said, okay, we're going to allow states to take over this decision making, and I applaud that decision. And now a number of states have put some pretty strict limits on abortion, but I don't think they're unreasonably strict. So you've got my disclosure. That's where I come from on this. So I thought we'd talk with Emily Harris, who's a reporter with Axios Portland, and she knows this subject well as well. Emily, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So tell me this. I've seen various stories that have said that Idaho has essentially banned abortion. They haven't done that. They've actually said you can't do it after 6 weeks. Isn't that a fair statement of what Idaho's law is now?
Well, what I was reporting on was data that was assembled by a group called the Society of Family Planning, which is trying to track how abortions have shifted since the Dobbs decision.
Right.
So what they were looking at was where abortions were done in the they took some data from April before the Dobbs decision and then tracked it through the rest of the year. And they were trying to see where abortions went down and where abortions went up. And what they found was that the number of abortions performed in Idaho dropped significantly to almost zero by the end of December and then rose in surrounding states, including Oregon.
Now, how much of a shift was there? Did all of those cases necessarily just go to another state and obtain the same operation or obtain the same medical service?
Well, they don't track, you know, individual by individual, right? What they did was reach out to all the abortion providers that they could. The people I spoke to were very confident about the Oregon numbers because they said that they were able to contact everyone who does abortions in Oregon. And they asked them, how many abortions did you do this month? And that's the essence of the research. And then in Idaho, they do the same thing. And what they found was in Idaho, like I said, it went almost to zero. And the numbers, I mean, they don't line up exactly, but like, for example, before the Dobbs decision, there was about 170 abortions a month being done in Idaho. And that dropped to about zero by the end of the 2022, so December. And then in Oregon, the number of abortions that were performed rose starting in June. And then between August and December, the Idaho trigger law that was triggered by the Dobbs decision went into effect in late August. And so between August and December, the number of abortions in Oregon rose by an average of about 150 a month more, you know, compared to April. And I should say these don't match the state numbers exactly. The Oregon Health Authority numbers, which abortion providers are required to report abortions to the state. But the state says their numbers are preliminary for that year and are subject to change.
Okay. And Oregon, most states don't gather a lot of data on who gets abortions or why they get them. I know Florida does, but other states tend to not gather much data at all. Is the Oregon information, the data gathering, pretty comprehensive so we know where people are from or why they're seeking an abortion?
So Oregon collects it by county, and they also track whether people were out of state. But actually, my understanding, and I've reported on this in the past, and my information about who reports, who collects data is that most states actually do, and they report to the CDC. The question of asking people why they're getting abortions has been a contentious issue over the last decade or so, and some states have put that into the surveys that they ask clinics to do. But that is a minority of states, if I remember correctly, that actually ask that question. But most states do report to the CDC. The CDC's numbers are usually pretty far behind as far as publishing numbers of abortions around the country. They're several years behind by the time they get published.
Well, the only reason I ask about the, or I started off by mentioning the, you know, the, that Idaho hasn't banned, they've said 6 weeks and above, the heartbeat idea is still the law. As I understand, they haven't gone to an outright ban. Why would the numbers drop to zero? Because, and let me tell you this for background, Emily, when Texas was talking about the heartbeat bill, I did some research of my own. I went to CDC data. And I said, well, they say that most women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. Surprise, surprise, CDC data indicates that about 50% of the abortions are obtained by women by 6 weeks. And the other 50% have come after 6 weeks. So clearly they know they're pregnant or they wouldn't be seeking an abortion. So to say that most women don't know or can't make the decision, about half of them make the decision before 6 weeks have gone by. So a 6 week ban does not, and that was from times where the law was basically, for a lot of states, was anytime, anywhere, any circumstances, up to the last minute, that some women would get it done before 6 weeks and some after 6 weeks. So saying a 6 week ban is a virtual ban on abortions not exactly matches up with the CDC data. Or does it? Can you give me a different perspective on that?
That's not something I've reported on recently, Lars, so I can't help you out there. But I can tell you that another thing people are paying attention to in Idaho is a law that was signed last month that would make it a crime to help a minor travel or get pills for an abortion without parental permission. So that traveling aspect is coming into play. And that's one thing that we'll be watching to see if that makes any difference as far as, you know, where abortion numbers are being recorded.
Well, and the other thing about that I find interesting is I don't think that a child should be able to get a medical procedure that has such far-reaching effects, both psychologically and physically, as an abortion, whether chemical or done by a doctor with hands. That I don't think that should happen to a child. That's my personal point of view. But we don't, in fact, know whether there aren't children who do go to mom and dad, say, I'm pregnant. Mom and dad say, we'll take you to the doctor. And the doctor says, well, you can have a chemical abortion, you can have the pills, and we'll take care of it that way. That there could be an awful lot of the cases that have shifted to that just with parental permission.
Something that's, right? I mean, not to interrupt you, but I think something that's more relevant to what I've been reporting on is that, you know, just looking at some of the things that Oregon is looking at doing. For example, there's a House Bill 2002, which would protect abortion providers here in this state against lawsuits or prosecutions from other states. But one of the other pieces, and that's been part of the big headlines about it, but one of the other pieces that bill would do is expand abortion services in rural Oregon, which, you know, depending on what these numbers continue to look like, could potentially be, you know, something that would be near the Idaho border, for example, as well.
Yeah. And so what they would do is effectively try to subvert Idaho's law by saying we can bring kids over here to have an abortion in Oregon right across the border. I think a lot of this is very, in fact, apparently the
you know,
authors
I,
of that.
I'm a reporter. I'm going to leave the opinion making to you, but that's pretty much all I've got as far as reporting goes on this.
I really appreciate it. That's Emily Harris, who writes for Axios. Emily, thank you very much. But I do point out 2002, that bill would legalize an abortion for a 10-year-old girl without parental consent, without parental notification, and that's a statement of fact. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Why do you think your polling is where it is?
Well, I don't think people, by the way, every major one who won re-election, their polling numbers were minor now.
Put polling aside then, right? Yeah, sentiment in this country, despite all these wins, is not very good.
All they've heard is negative news for 3 years. Everything is negative. And I'm not being critical of the press, but you turn on the television, the only way you're going to get a hit is if there's something negative. Anyway.
That's Joe Biden. Joe Biden, who sits there in a network television interview and says, well, You know, all I've had is negative coverage since the beginning of my presidency. Well, an awful lot of that negative coverage came because of negative decisions that Joe Biden himself made. I want to talk about that for a moment and where the polls put the presidential race of 2024 at this moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer and you disagree with my point of view, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. We post that two different places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and LarsLarson.com on the web. Now, I'm really, in some ways, enjoying all of this because here's what I'm anticipating is going to happen next fall. Now, things could change a lot between the fall of 23, which is still 6 months away, and the fall of 24, which is 18 months away. But do you know what's going on right now? The major media has declared, just as they did in 2015 and 2016, there is no way in the world that Donald Trump is going to get the Republican nomination, except that all signs point toward Donald Trump doing exactly that. At the same time, they've got an American president who has failed over and over and over again. I could spend an hour describing the massive failures of Joe Biden, and most of those failures were self-imposed failures, self-imposed errors, where he decided to do things like shut down America's oil production as much as possible, like decide to pull out of Afghanistan precipitously, which led to the deaths of 13 service members. It led to a president making a promise to rescue Americans before all military troops were pulled out of Afghanistan. That didn't happen. Thousands were left behind. It involves inflation, which in the first summer of Joe Biden's presidency in 2020, he claimed that's just transitory. It'll go away in a while. Well, here it is, 2023, heading toward the middle of 2023, and inflation is still with us. So you've got massive errors made by Joe Biden. So when he's asked about this, say, you got these low poll numbers. He says, oh, all presidents have those low poll numbers. Well, if you believe, and Joe Biden apparently believes it, that he didn't get any kind of honeymoon, he got a massive honeymoon from the press, because the press decided we're going to largely stop fact-checking him. They had fact-checked Donald Trump to a fare-thee-well. Every single thing the man said was fact-checked and called out as a lie. Or you'd get stories that led off by saying, well, the president, without any factual basis for it, said X or Y or Z. Well, Joe Biden does that virtually every day. And then what happened this past weekend? On one of the Sunday shows, as they're referred to, an ABC News panel were kind of stunned because they talked about a brand new poll that was done for ABC News. And the poll found that if the matchup were held today between Joe Biden, who seems to be the odds-on favorite to have the Democrat nomination, it probably won't be Joe dropping out and Kamala Harris getting in instead. It almost certainly won't be Gavin Newsom from California. When voters were asked for a preference, 44% of adults said they would definitely or probably vote for Trump, and only 38% said they would vote for Joe Biden. Now, that was a survey done in the latter part of April, early part of May, so it was only a couple of weeks ago. And as ABC anchor George Stephanopoulos, who I'll remind you, worked for the Bill Clinton administration, he's a hardcore left-wing ideologue, as far as I'm concerned. He says this poll is just brutal for President Biden. And that's a quote, by the way. The poll also found that 58% of voting age adults would prefer somebody else be the Democrat nominee, not Joe. And only 36% support Joe Biden getting the nomination. Most of the polls over the past year have found that most Democrats or Democrat-leaning voters would rather have a different presidential nominee. But they're not going to get it. The Democrats don't have a way to kick Joe Biden to the curb. And if they do, then they're going to have the prospect of Kamala Harris running and Gavin Newsom, and they're going to have to kick Kamala Harris to the curb as well. The potential matchup, when they do it in the poll and say, what if it was Biden versus Trump, and you throw in Ron DeSantis as well. Trump leads Biden 49-42. DeSantis tops the president, oh, Biden, that is, 48 to 41. So either one of the possible candidates, although I don't think Ron DeSantis is going to get the Republican nomination, I believe Donald Trump is going to get it, despite all predictions of the contrary. And I'm loving it that the mainstream media is ending up with egg all over its face because, of course, they've done everything they can to damn Donald Trump. They have said he caused the January 6th riot. No, not quite. He's committed all these crimes. No, not quite. They raided his house in Mar-a-Lago way back last August. And as soon as that raid happened, they said that must mean they're about to indict him. Well, it's May. It's mid-May or near to mid-May of 2023. The raid happened in August. Where are all those criminal charges? Joe Biden trails Donald Trump by 9% among independent voters after leading by 13% in the 2020 election. Of course, that's if you believe the result of the polls back then. His lead among black voters, this is Joe Biden's lead, has also dropped from 75% to 35%. Even all of Joe's racial demagoguery, which is belied by his crazy comments about race, because the guy's been a racist since the beginning of his career in the U.S. Senate. An Emerson poll that was done back in February, here's what it found. Trump is the likely only Republican contender who can defeat Joe Biden. He leads 46 to 42. That was in the poll in February. So the gap between Trump and Biden is getting wider and wider. It's also estimated Biden would defeat DeSantis 44 to 40. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley 40 to 37. And one poll called the Premise Poll found that Trump had a huge lead, 47 to 41 over Joe Biden. DeSantis just barely beats Biden at 39 to 38. So watch the mainstream media. They're going to continue to say, well, Donald Trump can't get the nomination because that's their only port in a storm. They're saying, well, we just can't have this happen again. Well, that's what you said in 2015 and in 2016. You denied the idea that he would get the nomination. Well, the problem is denials and predictions are one thing. What actually happens is something else entirely. And now you got Joe Biden trying to say to interviewers, oh, everybody has bad poll numbers like this. Joe Biden has had a cakewalk from the mainstream media as much as they possibly can with all the massive failures on energy, on inflation, on foreign affairs, on climate, the whole nine yards. And Donald Trump has stayed true to his values, and he continues to draw massive crowds to see what he has to say because Americans want him back as president, and nobody wants Joe in the Oval Office, not even the Democrats. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. And the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We have a massive mess on our southern border right now. It was caused by Joe Biden, in my estimation, because we had a largely under control border as Donald Trump left the White House. Joe Biden had campaigned on the idea of letting everybody cross in illegally. The number that I know from members of Congress is that in the last two and not quite 2.5 years, about 9 million people have illegally crossed into America. That is likely to be a record that we will never see eclipsed by somebody other than Joe Biden, although the next 2 years or a little less than 2 years of Joe Biden might actually be an even bigger number than the 9 million that have happened already. So what do we need to do to fix this problem? I invited Laura Reese on, who's a senior research fellow for Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation and former acting deputy chief of staff for the Department of Homeland Security. Ms. Reese, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
So what is the solution? And could Congress get a handle on this, even though the current commander-in-chief doesn't want to get a handle on it?
So the Congress needs to take back control over this issue and close some loopholes that this administration is exploiting, which includes asylum fraud. We had, during the last administration, used a brand new tool called Remain in Mexico, which said if you come to our border and say a few words of fear, we're not just going to release you into the U.S. where you'll disappear and then never even show up if you apply it for asylum at all, but you can wait in Mexico while your proceedings run its course. That, in conjunction with having agreements with governments of Central America that says we'll help you build up your respective asylum systems, But if someone goes through your country, doesn't apply for asylum, and comes to the U.S. and claims asylum, we're going to send them back to your country. Because asylum is about saving lives. And if someone is truly fleeing for their life, they should ask for protection in the first safe country in which they enter, not forum shop or country shop, and traverse multiple countries to get to the U.S. Those are some key aspects.
Yeah, and Laura, let me ask you, just so people are clear on this, when you say if you're leaving your country, if you're fleeing for your life, seeking asylum, not only should you stop in those other in the first safe country you arrive at that's willing to let you stay, that's international and U.S. law, isn't it?
It is. Many countries, most countries, have signed on to the asylum protocols, and that is part of that agreement. And so, but, you know, for many decades, the U.S. has been one of just a handful of countries that have taken in most of the refugees in the world for resettlement. And really, we need other countries to step up and to also resettle legitimate refugees. Now, we're not talking economic migrants, which many of these people are, and they admit as much. But they know that they can easily defraud our asylum system and come into the U.S., and that's what needs to be shut off.
I mean, because, Laura, one of the things that strikes me is that this is always cast as a problem of people seeking to save their own lives and escape persecution, which is very sympathetic. It's also cast as a problem of largely of families or women with small children. And yet I saw the report that I saw last night and another one this morning said almost everybody heading up to the border, as you and I are talking about this, are fighting age young males. They're not women. They're not children. They're not families. These are an entirely different crowd. And they want to come here out of the most base of motives, which is, I want to make more money, which everybody can appreciate. All of us would like to make more money as long as we do it legally. But if you say, well, their desire to make more money, that should let them in. The law doesn't support that, does it?
No. And when it comes to asylum, obviously the U.S. has been extremely generous in taking in true refugees. But the left, unfortunately, uses it as an emotional weapon, and they've so watered down the standards to asylum just to grant more people to come in and stay in the U.S., and they've really rendered what I view as the second most important immigration benefit after U.S. citizenship. They've rendered asylum meaningless, and yet they know that people on the right won't criticize this, because if you do, then, you know, the left calls you racist and everything else. And so the left has been successful at using this as an emotional tool to achieve their open border agenda, along with other things like unaccompanied alien children, using NGOs, including faith-based organizations, to process and transport many of these illegal aliens into and all over the country. They've been quite successful. So members on the right need to get the courage to call out these the abuse of these tools and to end abuse of them.
I mean, Laura, I'm with you because over the decades, I haven't had much use for the Red Cross. A long time ago, I supported them. I gave them pints of my blood and everything else and other donations. I don't any longer. But they're one of the agencies, an American organization, at least the American Red Cross, that's literally putting money in the hands of people who are trying to cross our border illegally. I almost think that if you, I don't know that you could do it at the state level, but if a state prosecutor were to say you are aiding and abetting illegal aliens to cross that border, that's a crime, isn't it? If you aid and abet somebody to violate American immigration law?
It is. If you transport or harbor or, aid in that, support in that, then, that is considered smuggling. And the Biden administration in their most recent proposed asylum rule talked about how cartels guide aliens along the final miles of their journey and that is smuggling. And then just a few pages later, they talk about how they rely on NGOs to receive and help with their onward travel of migrants. Well, that also is smuggling. And so the left will say, well, it's you can't go after these NGOs and the faith-based organizations. That's Catholic Charities, that's, you know, Lutheran Immigrant Refugee Services. That would be inhumane, and these groups are just helping vulnerable populations. Well, this is big money. They receive billions of dollars in federal grants to do this work. They've grown addicted to it, and now they're just trying to protect their funding.
Well, in fact, Laura, I'll make a comparison. I'm not asking you to join in this, but you remember the Holy Land Foundation, where we had people mm-hmm. of faith, Muslims, who said there's a jihad going on overseas and we're going to raise money to help that jihad. And they were convicted of the federal crime of raising money or giving assistance to terrorist activities. And you say, but that's part of their faith. Well, if faith-based groups here get involved in helping to traffic both children and adults across the border, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to say, well, for Christians, it's okay, but for Muslims in a different kind of fight, it's not. It's all criminal activity for a reason.
Yeah, and we've called on Congress to defund these operations. And unfortunately, in the House bill, Secure the Border Act, which House is going to vote on this week, there is language that says no funding for these organizations doing this type of work. So now it's going to come down to the appropriators to actually defund. Meanwhile, Secretary Mayorkas of Homeland Security keeps moving money around, including FEMA money, to spend hundreds of millions of more dollars on this. And this is a fiscal bottomless pit. And he said publicly, even with this latest reprogramming request that he just made within the past few days, that won't be enough either. So truly, there's no end to this.
So it means, and I want people to think about this, the next time we've got an earthquake, a storm, a tornado, a hurricane, whatever, in America, and FEMA says, well, we're short of cash to help out, they spent it on illegal aliens, and they did it at Joe Biden's bidding. Laura, thanks so much. That's Laura Reese from the Heritage Foundation, former acting deputy chief of staff for Homeland Security. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, which has for more than 23 years served the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. I want to put a couple of subjects in front of you, but I want to remind you first, this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. And our Twitter poll today, if the government sends out money by mistake, should it demand that the person who got the money pay it back? Now, before you say, well, of course. Well, I would say, of course, too. But here's what happened. Oregon Department of Human Services, which doesn't exactly have a stellar track record when it comes to things like this, they accidentally sent out thousands and thousands of pandemic EBT cards. Now, I know that most of you work a job, so you may never have had an electronic benefits transfer card. I've never had one. But what's on them is food stamps. It's also TANF, which is the fancy name for Temporary Aid to Needy Families, because that sounds so much more politically correct than saying welfare or the dole. But they sent out 1.46 million EBT cards by mistake, and they've now discovered their mistake. And they said, don't worry about paying it back. We got lots of money down here, and if we ever need more, we'd be glad to just hit the taxpayers up for more money. I would say, yes, you should have to send the money back. Anyway, you can answer the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. On Friday's Twitter poll question, here was the question: should the Grand Marshal of Portland's Starlight Parade be a drag queen? Now, if you're from outside the Portland area, every big city has a celebration every year that is supposed to be emblematic of the city. When I lived in Spokane, it was the Lilac Festival, and they had Bloomsday, the Bloomsday Run and all that. In Seattle, I would guess that either Bumbershoot or Seafair are the big, huge festivals that are put on as kind of emblematic of the city. For Portland, it is the Rose Festival. Now, the number one parade is the Grand Floral Parade. That's on Saturday, usually, but they have the Starlight Parade, which is, I think, a lot more fun. It's more informal. It happens on Friday night. And they usually choose somebody significant from the community to be the Grand Marshal. I've given the example that they use Bill Shonley, the late Bill Shonley now, but a great guy who is known by virtually everybody in the Northwest as the team announcer for the Portland Trailblazers. He was the Grand Marshal 1 year. But this year, Portland apparently decided it needed to do some serious virtue signaling. So they chose a drag queen that I would be willing to guess most people in the region have never heard of, Poison Waters. Now, drag queens, of course, have been in the news a lot because so many schools and so many public libraries have been putting on things like Drag Queen Story Hour. So you're taking people who are performers who dress up as women. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're transgender. They may just wear women's clothes. And you say, well, what's the difference between transgender and somebody who just dresses up? Well, the difference is one's doing it to perform, one is doing it because they actually believe they are a man who was born a man who now dresses and behaves and presents himself as a woman. And you say, well, why would you want to present that person to children? And the answer is pretty disgusting because I don't think there's any good motivation for that. So I said, should the Grand Marshal of Portland's Starlight Parade be a drag queen? I said no, so did 89% of you, and only 11% of you said yes. So, you want to jump in? It's 866-HEY-LARS. Let me mention a couple of things. One of them is where I see a tremendous opportunity. As you know, the politically powerful people in most of the Northwest, Oregon and Washington at least, not Idaho so much, the governors, many of the lawmakers have decided we're all going to go all electric all the time. They want to force you to buy an electric car. They want to force you to get rid of your natural gas furnace, your natural gas water heater, your natural gas cooktop, and they want you to use electricity instead. And some of us who I think are more sensible say, hold on a second, we're already going to be running short of electricity. And you say, well, why is that, Lars? Don't we have lots of electricity from hydro? Yeah, about 50% of the Northwest grid is hydro. The only problem is the other 50% is something else. Some of that is nuclear, although we're not building any new. We're building, I guess, the country has one new nuclear power plant and no more on the drawing board at this point. So where are we going to get this power? Not only are we going to run short of power as the Greenies ban things like coal-fired electric plants, the Northwest right now used to depend on 12 of them. Two of them were shut down early, Centralia and Boardman, and they're going to shut down more, including coal-fired electric plants that aren't even in the states of Oregon and Washington, but they send electricity here. And at the same time that that's going on, you've got data centers for big social media like Facebook and Twitter and the likes of that. And you also have what's called cryptocurrency mining. And what that is giant rooms full of computer servers that take huge amounts of electricity. And what do they produce out of that? Do they produce a product? Yeah, they produce cryptocurrency. They're not producing apples. They're not producing produce. They're just producing some more money out of all that power. And some of the state lawmakers better get a handle on this because we may run short of power while we're making crypto.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's my pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, where we try to serve the needs of the Pacific Northwest, at least the need for information. And if you want to jump into the best conversation and talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, I'll be glad to put you right to the head of the line. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I have to tell you something. One of the advantages the Pacific Northwest has over the rest of the country is that we have a tremendous amount of hydropower in the Pacific Northwest, to the point where it supplies 50 to 60% of the electricity. You only have to make up the difference from other sources, although the Greens are trying to cut that off as well. But now you've got some political figures that are trying to take away some of the hydro we already have. And not just that, but flood control, irrigation, transportation, recreation, and wildlife, all of that at the same time. And Joe Biden is involved in that question as well. Senator Mark Schessler joins me now, representing District 9. Yes, he's a Republican. I'd love to talk to some of his Democrat colleagues about this. Senator, good to have you back.
Well, great to be back on the show.
So what is the situation? Is Joe Biden hiding information about the Snake River dams? And does he really want to have them torn out, as some of the advocates in the Northwest are arguing for?
Well, I think he's an ally of those folks. If you look at the last round of hearings, they were totally stacked against proponents. No survey would have ever reflected that. And they allowed to completely stack a public hearing. Even the Wheat Growers Association, who is completely involved, was denied a spot at the table, even though they're one of the primary users.
How do we explain that? How do they get cut out of a process that, I mean, logically would involve people who are very dependent not just on the water, but on the transportation that these dams help facilitate?
Well, when you have a predetermined outcome, you move towards that outcome any way you can. And the Biden administration has so many radical allies that breaching the dams is not that big a deal to them.
Even though it ends up hurting the country when it comes to renewable power. And if you listen to the White House, they would tell you, oh, we're all about renewable and sustainable power and power that doesn't come from fossil fuels. Does that square up?
No, it doesn't. In fact, today we read Energy Northwest will be closing their reactor for 35 days to refuel. While that reactor is down, the Snake River dams reproduce megawatt per megawatt the power needed to replace that. No renewable could sustain that for 35 days except our dams. So you have one carbon-free source, our dams, making up for the refueling of the other carbon-free source, the nuclear reactor of Energy Northwest.
So is the fix in on this, Senator Schessler, to the point where they're going to get the conclusion that they seem to want? They're going to get the dams torn out, and the Northwest is going to be poorer for it?
Well, I think they've got a strong case because they control the executive branch. Fortunately, Congress controls the purse strings, and we have good allies in our congressional delegation. We also have two senators from Idaho that have a lot better attitude about our dams than our own senators.
Even though there are at least some members of the Northwest delegation who actually like this idea, is that not the case?
Well, we have Homer Simpson in Idaho that thinks we can buy our way out of it. But at the same time, his constituents at Idaho Power and Light don't even have fish ladders, the most basic thing there is, blocking off their river, which could be done for a tiny fraction of the cost of breaching our dams.
See, and that's the part that doesn't make sense to me. If you have these resources, you should be able to make use of them. And in an environment where you've got the White House and everybody else pushing the idea, we should have renewables, I'm not against them if they make financial sense. And the ones I think make the most financial sense are the ones we've already bought and paid for, the ones that are already in place. And if you need to add some fish ladders, good. Go ahead and do that. If you want to add other remediation, as they like to call it, you know, so that you can make up for fish that are lost because of the dams, fine. Go ahead and do that, too. But don't just tear them out.
Well, I think the most important thing you have to ask the proponents, what is the cost per kilowatt to the ratepayers for those alternatives? And that is a question they do not like to ask
or give answers to, because at the end of the day, we know pump storage is prohibitively expensive.
Yep.
We know solar without subsidies is prohibitively expensive. So always ask the question, what is the cost to the consumer?
Yeah, because, but that may be what their agenda is, Senator. I mean, let me suggest that for those people who think human beings should just simply use less power. I mean, as Barack Obama famously said, gasoline may have to go to $8 a gallon. And he said that better than a decade ago. And you say, why would you wish for $8 gas? Well, the simple answer is because people will use less of it. And maybe they're hoping that electric costs go up so dramatically that there won't be any, you know, you won't be able to afford to use as much as you're using now. So they can't get people to cut back on use of electricity, which we have in abundance or have had in abundance, unless you just price it out of reach. The problem is that hurts a lot of people, and it probably totals a lot of industries.
Well, at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. If you're going to electrify industries, electrify transportation, you need more and more. And, of course, we all want clean power. It's completely contrary to the goals that they've established. And I think all of us like a clean economy, but we also want a decent standard of living.
I mean, because I understand people say to me, they'll say, well, you want dirt in your, I said, you want to get rid of contamination? Get rid of human beings, because every community needs power. Every community needs water. Every community needs sewage treatment. And all of those things are inherently dirty at some level. And you say, do we try to make them as clean as we possibly can? Yes. But if you demand a high enough standard, you can simply wipe out people from that area altogether. Right? At least that's the way I look.
Well, as usual the case, we agree.
So what's the next step?
The sad part is, yeah, in the back of every budget, you see the money to support dam breaching studies. And I think as the governor comes to the signing date on the budgets, I think those little nuggets in the back of the budget will be the most interesting when somebody actually takes the time to read the entire thing.
Yeah, I think so, too. And if somebody has the guts as a reporter to ask the governor, so you want the dams torn out? And if you don't want them torn out, why are you spending all this money on studies? That's Senator Mark Schessler. He represents District 9 as a state senator in Washington State. In a moment. So you say, like me, that you don't trust the government and the CDC and the medical establishment. There's a brand new study out that suggests you're absolutely right not to trust them. That's next on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your calls. I know that, like a lot of you, I don't trust the government very much. I also specifically don't trust the Centers for Disease Control, known as the CDC. Now, that's an agency that, as a reporter, I've had a lot of dealings with the CDC over the decades. A lot of Americans became aware of some of the massive powers of the CDC at the federal level during the pandemic. And, of course, there is today a lot more distrust of the medical establishment. And frankly, I was kind of surprised, but it turns out there is a study, a brand new study out, that actually suggests that your distrust of those government agencies is actually well placed. Let me get to that in a moment. First, I want to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. But believe me, I will deliver on that promise. I'll give you statistical proof that the CDC is not to be trusted, even though Rochelle Walensky has announced that she is leaving the agency. She is one of the most poisonous and toxic administrators that we have in the federal government. Let me go first, though, to Wes, who's a naysayer. And Wes, as you know, on this program, we always put naysayers to the head of the line. I'm not going to violate that promise. And I had talked earlier about when the government accidentally, it says, sends out millions of dollars of EBT, electronic benefit transfer cards, in that case, monies that were sent out to provide food for kids during the pandemic. And then the government decides we sent the cards to the wrong people, and we actually sent millions of dollars out the door. Should the government try to recover that money? You say you're a naysayer on that subject?
Yeah, the reason why is because, well, I received two of them in the mail, and they were the same cards that we got during the pandemic. And when they sent them out in the mail, it didn't say anything, what they were for, anything like that. It just said how to activate them. So then, of course, we went ahead and activated them. And I've never been on welfare, and I've never had an EBT card except for, you know, the time they sent it for our kids in the pandemic and now. So my wife told me to, you know, use it. And I always do the grocery shopping on Sundays. And I didn't the first time because I always think it's kind of embarrassing to use it. But anyway,
I agree.
We went ahead and I had to explain to the cashier, like, hey, no, this is from the pandemic or whatever. But anyway, I don't think that we should have to pay that money back because I've already spent like $200 of it. And if it's their mistake, why should we pay for their mistake?
Okay, let me suggest you. I've never had the IRS accidentally send me a bigger tax refund, but I have a lady who does my taxes. She also does the bookkeeping for the radio show. If I got back a tax refund that looked suspiciously large, like I wasn't expecting that much back, say I was expecting back $2,000 and they send four, my first phone call would be to the lady who does my taxes because I'm too dumb to do taxes. And I'd say, was I supposed to get this much back? And she'd check her notes and say, no, you weren't. And if you spend it, they're going to come back for it later on. And when you went to the store and used the EBT card to buy, say, $200 worth of groceries, you saved, not you didn't spend the $200 you would have spent to buy those groceries, assuming you would have been buying the same groceries with the EBT card that you would have without the card, then you're not out anything if you pay the money back because you saved yourself $200. And I guess what I'd ask is morally and ethically, if you know that your fellow taxpayers funded those EBT cards and you took $200 you weren't entitled to, like you, I've never been on welfare, I've never taken food stamps. I've been poor in my life, and my parents were poor the whole time that they were married and alive. But I don't believe in taking money that I'm not entitled to. And so I guess I'd wonder what your argument would be for hanging on to the cash.
Well, because like I said, I didn't look into it, and I guess I should have. But like I said, it looked just like the cards that they had previously sent out. And to me, it's like, well, you guys made the mistake. We didn't. And I get the point as far as like the moral aspect of it, because I didn't even know that it was a mistake until you said so on the radio. And I was like, holy crap. So then I texted my wife, and she's like, oh, my gosh, it's a mistake. And I didn't know this until you said something. But then I disagreed with the fact that I was like, well, they made the mistake. And I get it. I mean, yeah, I'm not out anything if I would have to pay that money back. But as far as I'm concerned, as bad as the state of Oregon has done things and it's their mistake, then it should be their lesson learned and not something that comes back onto me. But
that's a fair point. I'll ask what people think about it. Wes, thanks a lot. We always appreciate the naysayer call. By the way, I did want to tell you about this new study about whether or not you should trust the CDC. It's actually a formal study. It's a published study. And here's what they found. They sought to compile instances of numerical and statistical errors made by the CDC during the pandemic. They went through CDC publications, press releases, Twitter accounts, and the whole nine yards. They documented 25 instances where the CDC had reported statistical or numerical errors. And get this, 80% of the times when they made an error, it exaggerated the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic. There were three instances that simultaneously exaggerated and then downplayed the severity of the situation. One error was neutral, and only one of their errors exaggerated COVID-19 vaccine risks. The CDC was notified of the errors, 16 of them, and then corrected 13 of them. So as they conclude, this is a scientific study. I can tell you where it came from. In fact, I can cite that because I'm always glad to cite my sources on things like this. It's from, who published it? Statistical and numerical errors made by U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I can send you the link if you'd like to see the link. Because I found this fascinating. They actually went back and found all the times that they exaggerated the numbers to make the point. The pandemic is worse than you think. And only one error where they had exaggerated vaccine dangers, which I think are really serious. And what they conclude is that a basic prerequisite for citizens to make informed decisions is accurate and reliable statistics, even during times of uncertainty. Their investigation revealed, and this is a quote from the report, 25 instances of numerical or statistical errors made by the CDC. Our investigation suggests the need for greater diligence in data collecting and that the federal entity responsible for reporting statistics should be firewalled from the entity setting policy because of concerns about real or perceived bias in those errors. In other words, when they falsely tell the public, yeah, this is really, really bad, and then they find out they have an error, but they're also the same agency that's expected to, say, promote vaccinations or promote the idea that there's a real problem, they might just forget about correcting the errors because it works the opposite direction from where the agency wants to go. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to jump in to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your phone calls and emails. But I want to talk about the militarization of the IRS. Now, when I use that term militarization, a couple of years ago, there were people who were out marching in the streets, you know, Antifa and BLM. They burned down big parts of American cities. They caused about $3 billion in damage. There were murders. There was looting. There was arson and everything else because they objected to what they called the militarization of the police. In other words, police that actually carry guns and have gear to protect them when they wade into a mob of people who have no right to do what they're doing. That's one thing. But when you militarize an agency, it's supposed to be a bunch of guys and gals with green eye shades who are smart at numbers, and they figure out what people owe or may owe beyond what they've paid. The IRS is supposed to simply be the government agency that makes sure that people pay the taxes that they owe. To arm them up with semi-automatic or even maybe fully automatic weapons and all this other military gear, you got to wonder what's going on. And the man who supplies the numbers for all that is our friend Adam Angievsky, CEO and founder of Open the Books. And of course, he wears as a badge of courage that he was fired as a columnist at Forbes magazine. Adam, welcome back.
Great to be on the program, Lars. Thanks for having me back.
Would you mind characterize for my audience just how bad the militarization of the IRS appears to be based on the numbers?
So here's the IRS gun locker before the pandemic. Before the pandemic, the IRS owned 4,500 guns that included over 600 shotguns, 500 AR-15-style rifles, and even 15 submachine guns. And this is what they've purchased after the pandemic. So after the pandemic, they spent $2.3 million on duty ammunition, $1.2 million on ballistics shields, plus another $1.3 million on various other gear for criminal investigative agents, which is a very non-transparent description. They spent another $500,000 on the Smith & Wesson AR-15-style rifles, $500,000 on duty tactical lighting, $500,000 on Beretta tactical shotguns. They have so much gear for their nearly 3,000 special agents that they spent $354,000 on bags, tactical gear bags, for their special agents.
$750,000 just on the bags to carry the gear when they're in the field. I guess, Adam, the one thing the numbers don't describe, but I'm curious if you had some insights into this, is why does the agency need all this? And let me say in support of that question, I know that the IRS usually deals with boring stuff. You know, the taxpayer sends in his taxes, the IRS looks at the filing and says, nah, you left a bunch of stuff out, you owe some more. They send a notice to the taxpayer groans and says, okay, I owe some more. Or they talk to their tax person and they figure out how much more they owe or don't owe. And if necessary, you get an audit. And it's all very peaceful and all very copacetic. Then you've got a few people who may go almost militant, say, I'm not paying the IRS a dime, I'm a sovereign citizen or whatever, and they've said, okay, I'm just not going to pay. At some point, the IRS has to come and take your stuff, as they may be legally entitled to do. They put liens on your bank accounts. If you've got physical assets, they come to get them. I can imagine a few of those kinds of things, but there can't be that very many, are there?
Well, in that last situation, you've got 27 traditional federal law enforcement agencies that can be called. So what you're seeing here with the Internal Revenue Service and 75, literally 75 other traditional regulatory, civil, general administrative agencies that are arming up, gunning up, what you're seeing is the blurring of the lines between those formally administrative agencies and those agencies having their own police power, their own law enforcement duties. And so you've got 27, like I said, traditional law enforcement agencies. Those people can be called. It's the U.S. Marshals. It's the FBI. Yep. You can split, and there's a real public purpose to split the duties between the administrative agencies and the law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, because, for example, Adam, I know that the DEA, which is a part of law enforcement, when they need assistance on a raid, so DEA is Drug Enforcement Administration, when they want to go out and do a drug raid, they find somebody who's trafficking fentanyl, and before it goes out and kills a bunch of people, the DEA wants to stage a raid. When they need to do that, they oftentimes call the FBI or the marshals. They also call local law enforcement, the local sheriff, wherever this raid is going to happen, or the local police department if it's in a city. They have, even that agency calls on others to help them out when they say this could be a tough one or a dangerous one. We want some extra help. And they get that extra help. Why is has the IRS any way justified why they need all this extra armament?
So every single year since 2016, we broke this story, Lars, on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal back in 2016 with our then honorary chairman, the former legendary U.S. Senator from Oklahoma, Dr. Tom Coburn. I co-authored that piece with him. And every single year we go out for comment to the IRS. The last time they responded was 2021, and they said that their special agents have been using weapons throughout their history as they've consistently found themselves investigating the most dangerous criminals involved in organized crime, drugs, and gangs. And look, we don't want our law enforcement officials to be outgunned. What we're pointing out here is the blurring of the lines, between the civil general enforcement agencies and traditional law enforcement agencies.
Well, and Adam, tell me this, because it came up not long ago. Do IRS agents have the power to arrest you?
Yes.
They
absolutely
do.
Yes. Okay. And as a matter of fact, within the 76 federal traditional administrative agencies, their inspector generals are not only do they have arrest and firearm authority, but they also have the ability to subpoena and to convene a grand jury. So we have really empowered these non-law enforcement agencies with a lot of power.
Well, and not only that, but if you say they can convene a grand jury, that means they can be the investigative agency, the arresting agency, and the prosecuting agency. And then their prosecutorial decisions are simply what? Backed up by the DOJ? Or do their lawyers go into court and actually prosecute people?
I think that the prosecution would lie elsewhere. But let's tease that out for a second. Because the National Institutes of Health, you've got this Inspector General Corps. And they have all the powers that we're talking about. Okay, so at the height of the pandemic in March of 2020, Dr. Anthony Fauci was receiving death threats, and his safety was in jeopardy. And so traditionally, the U.S. Marshals would have handled his security detail. But the HHS Inspector General, the very people that were supposed to be holding Fauci accountable during the pandemic, they applied for special power through the U.S. Marshals to provide the security detail for Fauci. Fauci was actually being protected by the HHS and IG, the Inspector General, the very people that were supposed to be holding him accountable.
That doesn't sound right. It sounds like you've crossed the lines and you've created a situation where, is there any accountability at that point then?
Well, and that's what we've always said. Fauci was untouchable, unaccountable. He was unfireable. He was, you know, over the course of his 50-some year career, he had built quite an island for himself.
Where do we go from here? And is there anybody who can pull this back? Could the Congress say we're just not going to fund this?
Yes. As a matter of fact, you know, when we highlighted this issue in 2016, the Trump administration, they identified this problem. And by 2017, on their reorganization of the federal government paperwork, in their plan, they had planned to strip those rank-and-file federal agencies of their arrest and firearm authority and transfer it back to the traditional law enforcement agencies. So right now we're calling on Congress to hold hearings on the gun locker and these 76 agencies, and we'd like to testify.
Absolutely right. That's Adam Andrzejewski from Open the Books. Adam, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. Your calls are welcome. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you on board. And if you want to jump into the best conversation and talk journalism, it happens right here on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, with more than 20 local radio affiliates that we don't nearly say thanks to enough. But thank you very much to all our great radio affiliates who've been with us the better part of 24 years. This segment of the show is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. 541 ONAGEN. That's 541 ONAGEN. Now, our Twitter poll today. If the government sends out money by mistake, should it demand that you pay it back? I would say yes. I mean, I'm not crazy about the government, whether it's federal or state. But when the state government accidentally takes the taxpayers' money and sends it to somebody who's not entitled to get it, that's exactly what happened when Oregon Department of Human Services mistakenly sent out, they say, thousands of pandemic EBT cards. That's electronic benefits transfer cards, otherwise known, I call them welfare cards. When you're standing behind somebody in the line at the grocery store and they get a big basket of groceries for several hundred dollars and they haul out their EBT card, it either has on it food stamps or what's known as TANF, Temporary Aid to Needy Families, what the rest of us used to call welfare or the dole. Well, they accidentally sent out $1.46 million to people who are not entitled to receive it. Now those people are being told, well, the government isn't going to make you pay it back. So in other words, that's the way they treat your money. I don't think that's very respectful to the taxpayers out there. So I'm asking you, if the government accidentally sends out taxpayer money by mistake, should the people it was sent to have to pay it back? I would answer yes. In Friday's Twitter poll on First Amendment Friday, I asked whether the Grand Marshal of Portland's Starlight Parade should be a drag queen, and one not widely known. I mean, if you want to remind me that years ago, Darcell was the Grand Marshal of the Starlight Parade, that's fine. The late female impersonator, Darcell, who was not transgender, he was gay, but he liked to dress up as a woman. And he was very, very well known in the community. I suspect that Poison Waters, who's the drag queen chosen for the Grand Marshal of Portland Starlight Parade, not nearly so well known. And if you say, well, these parades are signature civic events, they're supposed to represent the community. Can somebody tell me how that properly represents the community to have somebody who's not well known but is a drag queen? I think it's just Portland trying to do a bunch of virtue signaling. I said no to the idea. 89% of you joined me in that no vote. Only 11% of you voted yes. And I even got emails on it. For example, Patricia wrote in, Lars, I love listening to your show. Thanks, Patricia. I have to disagree about paying back the EBT cards that were sent out recently. I received a letter stating that they were sending out the cards and why they were doing it. That was several weeks before it was received. Therefore, the state had time to fix their mistake. I've paid my taxes, and I don't feel I need to give back what they had time to fix. Love the show. Signed, Trish B. And Trish, I appreciate that. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Mark wrote in from Bellingham, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KGMI, and he asked me about something that's a little bit inside baseball, although I have mentioned it on the show before. He said, Lars, I'm interested in what you know about getting rid of AM radio. Is there any truth to this? And he said he likes to listen on KGMI, which is an AM radio station. I've actually been in their studios. I've done the show several times from KGMI studios. I'm concerned about that too, Mark, and for a number of reasons. Not just because I got my start in radio, in AM radio. That's not a good reason to keep it around. But here's what's going on inside the industry. The folks who make cars are considering, some have already acted on this, getting rid of AM radio, meaning that they would no longer make brand new cars that have AM radios in them. And one of their reasons for doing this, I mean, whether it matters to you or not, is they say, well, we're making a lot of electric cars. And it turns out that car radios that use the AM band instead of the FM band don't react very well to all the electrical interference that they get in an all-electric car. I still don't think that's a good reason to get rid of AM radio. And I would point this out to you. Over the decades in America, AM radio stations have been a stalwart part of our community defense. That is, when you have a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake, FM is great, except it is line of sight. So if you have anything in the way, if you have a mountain in the way, if you have buildings in the way, FM radio can be problematic. In fact, in New York City, they get what they call picket fencing. If you were to put on an FM radio and drive down the street with those big, tall buildings on both sides of the street, you'll literally hear the signal come and go as you come to intersections. So that's sort of the inside baseball part of it. Do I think it's a great idea that when you've got a chip in a car that will do satellite, it'll do FM, it'll do MP3 audio, it'll do everything in the world, and it can do AM radio too, and then the car makers say, well, AM is kind of inconvenient. I see this as more of a political attack. Most of the radio stations that carry talk radio in America are on the AM band. We have a lot of FM stations as well, including our flagship station, KXL. But those AM radio stations, that's the heartbeat of the biggest single radio format in America, which is talk radio. And I think there's more of a political message if the car makers say, let's get rid of it, because the Democrats love the idea of getting rid of talk radio.